Hello and welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is Friday the 27th of March 2020 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live at RadioAlbion.com with a new intro. And also we have with us tonight the producer of Adolf Hitler, the greatest story ever told, Communism by the Back Door, the Freemasonic victory of World War II, and the very soon to be released Churchill's Body Count, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, good evening, sir. How the devil are you?
I'm fine, considering Boris and the Prince have got the bug.
Yeah, they've got the plague, haven't they? And Trudeau's wife as well, and I think the health minister and Tom Hanks. It's taking down all the celebrities, isn't it?
It could be divine intervention, what I've been talking about for a long time now.
Well, I think you might be right there. It reminds me of sort of that prophecy in the New Testament about the four horsemen and the angel and the plagues and the wrath of God. And then what we have to come after that is Babylon the Great falls. And, you know, that could well be the recession.
Yeah, because it was getting a bit too much like Babylon for my liking, so who knows?
Well, that seems to have put a stop to it. I mean, someone was pointing out in the chat room earlier that all the news of the stabbings that were taking place in London, they seem to have stopped. So it's put a stop to that. I should imagine it's put a stop to the prostitution that was going on. But the other side of it is everybody's got to stay indoors. Yeah. Oh, and also they said that they wouldn't be able to perform any abortions because of this. Yeah, no transsexual operations, not going to be able to perform any of them. So, there are silver linings to what's going on.
Certainly, yeah.
We can put it that way. One silver lining is that you must have had more time to be working on your documentary, Dennis.
Yeah, well, I think I've more or less wrapped it up, to be honest, here, because I didn't want it to go on forever, and I've got another one in mind as well for what I want to do, so... We do it today. I mean, I'll probably have to, I've just got a rough count. I mean, it could be an estimated count anyway at the end of it all, but, I think, after several weeks of actually delving into this fat lunatic's life, you know, I'm ready to call it a day and crack on.
So you think you've got the series finished? I mean, how many parts is it that you actually made in all?
Do you know what? I counted up the other day and I'd forgotten one, which was Calliope. So I think there must be about seven or eight, maybe something like that. I might be wrong.
Seven or eight. So that's going to be probably about an hour and a half then in all.
Yeah, nothing like the the usual marathon.
And are you going to add music to them yet, or add a few more bits and pieces?
I probably will add bits and pieces and some music, yeah, because some of the music I've used, it's only because I've been getting them over to you quite quickly. You know, they were already there, so I can go a bit more deep into all that once I crack on with it. But the alternative thing what I want to do as well, once it's finished, is I learned from that debate which I had the other week that not a lot of people really realise. I mean, I made the last documentary, but take for instance, someone was saying that it wasn't really a reason for Stalin to be a Freemason, when I was saying by Freemason's rules alone that he couldn't sit with these other people, especially with war secrets. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, take Stalin for instance, I'm going to find as much detail as I can. I know there's a couple of instances where he's actually doing Masonic signs, and I know Lenin and Trotsky, although you're supposed to mention, you know, that you believe in a great architect of the universe, these were supposed to be atheists. But I do know, I think it's the Grand Orient in France, which accept people who don't believe in the great universe in the sky. And so Stalin could have quite easily been one of them. I'm going to try and make the case that Stalin has to be a Freemason, because every single person that sat down on that bench with either Roosevelt or Churchill or Truman, they were all Freemasons.
Well, they had to be by their own rules, didn't they? As you were saying, you know, they couldn't sit there and divulge secrets with anybody else who wasn't a Freemason. And on top of that...
That's right, yeah.
On top of that, you've also got the documentary that Duralina produced, which was showing that the Bolshevik Revolution was all set up by Freemasons.
Well, that's funny that because I emailed him a while back when I was doing Communism by the Back Door, and I asked him, did he think that Stalin was Freemason? And he said no. And the reason he gave was because he purged Freemasonry he purged everybody, to be honest, but he purged Freemasonry early on in his early days. And I looked into all that, and I found out that he did purge Freemasonry, but he didn't purge the Jews in the Freemason lodges, just the non-Jews.
So he just got rid of the Jewish stooges, the Freemasons.
The guy, yeah.
And of course, once they've taken power, they've not really got any use for the Freemasons anymore, have they?
Exactly. I mean, these are the people that are going to winch more than anybody. So, you know, if they don't get any piece of the action, so, you know, that's the reason why they do get rid of them. But this particular guy, in all honesty, I accept his point. He did say, surely he could have sat down with him because, you know, he probably had the biggest army on the planet and all this great power. But the argument to that is he only got that because he was a member of the club.
Right. Well, just one more question before we move on to tonight's subject. Then, sure. Just about the new documentary. Is it going to come out in separate parts, like 6 or 7 parts, or are you going to make it into a 90-length feature documentary?
Well, if Bitchute will accept the full length, yeah, I'll do it full length. I mean, the reason I did, well, there's a couple of reasons, but I couldn't really do it a full length on YouTube because you had to, you had to give more details than I was willing to give. So I stuck to the 15 minutes, but it served its purpose anyway.
So it will eventually get a premiere on BitChute then?
Yeah, that's probably the only place that I'm allowed these days anyway.
apart from your own websites, of course, and I'm sure there'll eventually be a website dedicated to it, I'm sure. Let's get into tonight, which is going to be based on this final episode, which basically looks at Churchill's bad behaviour during the war. It has the totting up of the final body count, and it begins with a left-wing Scottish MP for the Green Party and him attacking Winston Churchill, which I believe was on the television fairly recently. It was on the ITV Breakfast with Piers Morgan, and it made quite a few ripples, this did. The interesting thing is that some of what he says is very true, but I don't really agree with his conclusions. So we'll look at that. So when did you first hear about this, Dennis? Did you actually see him when it was on the television or anything like that?
Yeah, well, this is what inspired me to do this documentary, because I heard Piers Morgan going on saying how wonderful Churchill was. We just had the Oliver movie saying how wonderful he was. And although this guy, like you said, you know, I don't agree with everything he says, like, and he's a left-winger, he was making some valid points, but he was getting abused off Piers simply because Churchill had won the war. And, that was good for Piers. You know, it could have been Jack the Ripper's son for all he cared.
Yeah, Piers Morgan's answers really, you know, they don't really rebut anything that the left-wing MP has to say. Well, let's begin with that then. And actually, do you know the name of this MP? I did look it up earlier because I got an image of him, but I didn't actually add it to the notes.
No, it's not. it's not.
is a ginger-haired green MP from Clyde Bank.
Yeah.
At least we know that. Well, this is what he has to say to Piers Morgan. He always advocated the most violent, most destructive option. He used poison gas against the Kurds, against the Afghans. He was a strong supporter of Britain's concentration camps in the Boer War, where 28,000 women and children died. He always advocated the use of aerial bombardment of civilians in what he termed terror bombing campaigns. In fact, his own cabinet had to stop him from bombing protesters in Ireland. And if we look at that, I mean, because he's made this accusation that Churchill was a bad guy, but he's also made this accusation that Churchill was a white supremacist. And yet a lot of the people that Churchill was attacking here were actually white. The Boers, they were white. The Irish, they were white. Yeah. The terror bombing campaigns in Germany, they were white. So So this allegation that Churchill was a white supremacist is, you know, his own argument.
It's a stretch of it.
Goes against that and proves that that is not true. But the rest of it does show that he was a mass murderer. We got Piers Morgan's response. Piers Morgan says, but the power of his rhetoric saved Britain from the Nazis in World War II, and he was voted the greatest Briton of all time. So for Piers Morgan, he could kill as many people as he wants, so long as he's a smooth talker. So long as he's got the gift of the gab, it doesn't matter how many people he kills. I mean, that's not an argument, is it?
Well, the twist then as well, he's saying that he saved us from the Nazis when the Nazis offered 22, at least 24 peace treaties. So did he really save us from the Nazis?
No, he just kept the war going, didn't he? When you look at it like that.
Exactly.
When you look at it like that, he could have saved us. He could have saved us from the Nazis, and he could have averted the war just by accepting the peace treaty. And the peace treaty never had, we will have peace if you allow us to invade Britain, did it? It was, borders.
They didn't even send a reply back on any of them, I don't think. But, the excuse that, Hitler breaks treaties anyway, often is used. But, you know, the fact is, Hitler didn't want war, and that's been proven, you know, since that time.
I think the only times that Hitler did break treaties was only when other countries had already done so.
Yeah. Stalin.
Yeah, like the arming, when they weren't supposed to arm, it was all of the countries that sat around that table at the Versailles Treaty that were supposed to not be rearming and not increasing their armaments.
That's right. He told them, look, I'll disarm now. Let's all get around the table and let's all disarm. But they wouldn't. So he's not going to.
So he had to, you know, the treaty had already been broken by them, basically. And the other treaties, well, they weren't really treaties. It was the Versailles Treaty, which was under duress. And it said in that treaty that people that, or nations should be given their right to self-determination. And then what did it do? It gave Danzig to Poland. It split up bits of Germany. Yeah. Where was their self-determination? They didn't have self-determination. They were being occupied by foreigners. So again...
Yeah, they're supposed to have rights as well. They never got any rights, you know, human rights in Poland.
So treaties were broke there. Well, then we get the response from this MP. He says, I almost was never born because Churchill refused to provide anti-aircraft batteries for the Clyde Bank, and it was bombed to smithereens during the war. He hated the workers, and he even used the army against Welsh miners protesting for better conditions. And I would answer that and say, well, he hated the British. You know, he hated the British, didn't he? Look how many British people he sent to war.
That's all right.
Before then, you've got him attacking the Welsh miners. You've got him calling to... bomb Ireland. You know, he didn't have any loyalty to the country that he was supposedly from. The only loyalty he ever had was to the Jews.
Well, to be fair to him, Mike, the government today is to me, is just the same. You know, it's a government that doesn't like its population, which is why it's trying to replace it.
Well, at least the government today hasn't sent, you know, millions of us off to die in a war and kill millions of other Europeans. I mean, Boris Johnson's nowhere near as bad as Winston Churchill.
Oh no, but I'm thinking of things like the Muslim grooming gang never got in touch for 2 decades. And they don't make it.
Good point. Just a different kind of evil that's allowed happen to us. Piers Morgan responds. He says, "You seem to be promoting a completely isolated and unique version of history." So Piers Morgan has obviously never heard this before. And the Scottish MEP comes back with a good answer. He says, if you go to India, Ireland, Kenya, the Clyde Bank, South Wales and elsewhere, you will hear these views. And those views are not allowed to be heard because the prevailing narrative is of a war hero that you cannot speak ill of. We need to start being honest about our own history. It was the sailors, the soldiers and the army who won that war. And the first thing they did when they came home is vote Churchill out of office.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so important, that to hammer that point home to people that do think he's a hero. If the British people thought Churchill was a hero, why did they vote him out of office the first chance they got? And don't forget, he also suspended.
You just wouldn't have got odds of the bookies, would you? I mean, when Thatcher won the Falklands, you know, her popularity soared. And he's won World War II, when he's getting kicked out.
But he also suspended elections as well. As soon as he was given power, because to form that coalition to go into war, they said, "Yeah, we'll form a coalition, but you have to get rid of Chamberlain. But we will accept Churchill." And this is obviously because I would suggest because the Jews had been backing Churchill all this time. Churchill looked to the Jews as his best friends. They brought him up when his dad died, very very close to them, as we've already covered. And then you've got the Labour Party as well, and the Labour Party was supported by a lot of Jews. So obviously the Jews involved in that Labour Party, their favourite in the Conservative Party was Winston Churchill. So they said, yes, we'll advise you to join up with this coalition so long as Churchill is in office. And as soon as he was put in office as Prime Minister, he suspended all the elections, and the British people never got a chance to vote him out. They never got a say in whether they wanted to go to war. Yeah, he was a dictator for the whole of that war. And then they voted him out of office. And it's good that this guy is saying this. But he did get really roasted for it, and he's a total communist, and he is a total communist. But he, you know, he's speaking the truth there, that you can go to India, Ireland, Kenya, South Wales, Clydebank, and you will hear about a different Churchill to the one that Hollywood has told you about. So well, it was good that this was on
the matter of the Welsh miners, and only two died. But the significance of that is that he turned the British army on its own population, which is really should be unheard of. But he did it, and lives were lost, even though it was only two. I mean, the significance of that is bone-shaking.
Well, it just shows you that, you know, it even when it's close-up individuals, just two people, he's still quite happy to do it. I mean, you could say, well, when he's killing, like, thousands of people, bombing loads of people, they're faceless, they're nameless, they're in another country. Yeah. But as you say, these were his own people, and these were just miners that were protesting for better work conditions.
That's right.
His answer was just to kill them. And just to go back to what this guy says at first, you know, in this first bit, he says he always advocated the most violent and most destructive option. And I think that's what you've shown in this series, is that it was always the most violent, most destructive option. That's what Churchill would go for. That's why I was saying, he's no good as a leader of a country. What he should have been doing is, part of the army. Well, he could have been, I don't know, just put there in a savage army platoon that was, you know, right up the front there to just go and attack people.
But he was a blundering idiot at warfare, as we'll find out.
Totally. Well, then you have a quote from him, which is absolute hypocrisy. And he says, upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization.
Well, is it hypocrisy? Or is he really telling the truth? Because even though he says that, he's siding with the biggest Christian killers of all time, the Bolsheviks. So is he really speaking the truth?
Well, yeah, you got a good point there, Dennis. I was going to say, because if we look around us, is this Christian civilization that we've got then? Transsexuals, tranny story hour, race mixing, promotion of anal sex.
If you're fighting for Christianity, the last person you're going to side with is Stalin.
Well, yeah, he is telling the truth here. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization, but Christian civilization lost the battle. He was fighting against the Christian civilization, which was headed up by the National Socialists.
Yeah, because technically you've got half a dozen nations going into the Soviet Union, Christian nations, to take down Stalin, who's been killing Christians. The Soviet Union's been killing Christians since the revolution. And then two so-called Christian countries like Britain and America are then sending aid to Stalin. Now, if that don't tell its own story, nothing will.
So I think what he was doing here in saying this, I mean, he was still trying to pull the wool over people's eyes, I think. I think he was trying to put himself across as being the Christian and the Germans as being the anti-Christians. Mm. And because of the lack of information that was coming out of Germany, he could get away with that. I mean, we've covered, haven't we? We've covered these allegations in the press that were saying that Hitler was rewriting the Bible and making everybody pray to him and all this sort of nonsense.
Yeah, that, yeah,
we've debunked. So Churchill was trying to present himself as the face of Christian civilization and Hitler as the devil, basically.
Mm.
But next we move into a bit of narrative, a bit of text narrative. Churchill's determination for war. Secret government documents reveal that the British received 24 offers of peace deals between 1939 and 1941, despite their military straits after the evacuation at Dunkirk. But Prime Minister Winston Churchill would have none of it. Because he was aware Britain could not defeat Germany alone, he would do his utmost to drag the United States into the war. And when speaking to President Truman in Fulton, USA in 1946, he would explain, "We could have, if we intended so, prevented this war from breaking out without doing one shot. But we didn't want to." So there's your admission. People that say that, how is Churchill responsible? How do you know Churchill wanted war? There is the admission right there. If they wanted to prevent it, they could have done so without firing a shot, but they didn't want to. And he's talking to Truman, isn't he? So he's saying him and Truman.
Truman's well clued up, but it's despicable to think, just when you realise what this person was and what he'd done and how he actually wanted war, that he gets so much praise. That's like I said, I just felt I had to do this body count.
And these peace offers, I mean, the first one was right after Germany went into Poland. Right after that, there was a peace offer, and Mussolini was trying to referee it, trying to arrange all of it. And I think, what was it Britain said? You would have to go back to Germany, and then we'll accept it, or something like that. And it was just unheard of for somebody to, you know, go into another country, win against that country, and then just go back to their borders. Because I mean, that, you forget, the whole point of that was to liberate the Germans that were in Danzig and prevent what was happening to them.
That's right. Which again was hidden from World War II at the beginning for people at that time with no internet.
Then we can get up to Dunkirk, and what we've got there is we've got an incredible victory where Hitler could have, you know, he could have destroyed all the British troops, or he could have taken them prisoner, but he didn't want to do that. He thought that it would be accepted that he had won, he had had the victory, and to save a loss of human life, the honourable thing to have done would have been to accept Hitler's peace terms. And what were his peace terms? You know, it wasn't, you know, I want to occupy Germany and be the leader of Germany, the king of Germany.
No. It would have been on terms agreeable to everybody. But, I mean, I'm not convinced Churchill makes the decisions anyway, but, you know, I'm sure he went along with the decision. You know, his backers obviously didn't want to lose what they had up to 19... Well, what they gained after World War One, which was all of Europe and all the usury and everything else, which the control of the continent, they didn't want to be settling with the peace treaty. They wanted it back under any circumstances.
And all the countries that were occupied by Germany, they were all expecting to get their sovereignty back at the end of the war. It was all just a temporary thing to have Germany there, and it was just to prevent the country being used by the Allies to go through to get against Germany. Every single one of those countries had signed a thing with the armistice, and they were expecting to get their country back as soon as hostilities had ceased. It wasn't Hitler invading Europe, Hitler trying to take over all of Europe. It was just protecting Germany from the Allies using those countries. And they were going to use those neutral countries, weren't they? If Hitler hadn't got in there first Norway.
Norway.
You know, that's the best example of it, isn't it? You know, we've got these plans.
Yeah, they failed on that one.
And also that, I mean, preempting that came from the behaviour that we'd already seen from Churchill in World War One, where he was using the neutral shipping to attack Germany.
Yeah, and the starving of the Germans to force them to accept the Versailles Treaty. You know, a secret blockade.
So they knew that anything, any neutral countries would be used by Churchill, because they had this previous examples
record. Of using. Yeah, yeah. So when people say, "Oh, you can't trust Hitler; he's always breaking peace treaties," well, they never lined up, you know, the British for 12 months and said, "Sign this and starve them to death." Like, this despicable.
Well, again, not without signing under duress, isn't it?
Yeah.
Torturing somebody to sign something. So that's an example of Churchill's determination for war. And next we've got an incident that you didn't really cover, I don't think, in Greatest Story Never Told, the loss of Singapore. Did you mention it in that, Dennis?
Yeah, I mentioned it, yeah. But what I didn't realise is what we'll come to shortly about some people say that it's, the nuclear bombs are missed these days, instead of a firebomb, but I didn't realise what control the Quebec Treaty gave Britain in that bombing.
So Britain were involved in the bombing of Hiroshima, but Singapore was something that you didn't really cover.
And yeah, it was, I did. I explained that it was Churchill who said it was the biggest tragedy of the British Empire, but then, you know, historians have to look to Churchill, for the blundering things that he, methods that he didn't think that the Japanese were capable of taking Singapore and was underestimating them.
So his arrogance. Well, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the Japanese would now try and rid the region from the domineering Western powers of Britain and the United States. On Christmas Day 1941, they captured Hong Kong from the British. The Philippines, Burma, and British Malaya would all fall in quick succession. However, their greatest prize would be taking the British stronghold of Singapore. Vastly outnumbered, 30,000 troops would force 100,000 British, Australian, and Indian soldiers to surrender. It turned out to be one of the most humiliating defeats ever for the British Empire. Winston Churchill described the fall of Singapore as the worst disaster and largest capitulation in British history. Later historians would point the finger at Churchill himself for the failure and the blunders he made by underestimating the Japanese. And it wasn't just that he underestimated the Japanese. I looked into this afternoon, and there's quite a few interesting bits about this that we're not really told about. But the British troops, they were actually defeated by light tanks and bicycle infantry. Bicycle infantry managed to defeat them. 30,000 Japanese troops against an enemy of 100,000, and the 30,000 Japanese troops, the majority of them are on push bikes. And that's incredible. And it was the largest surrender ever in the history of Britain. And we got a report from Churchill's personal physician, Lord Narran. He wrote, "The fall of Singapore on February the 15th stupefied the Prime Minister. How came 100,000 men, half of them of our own race, to hold up their hands to inferior numbers of Japanese? Though his mind had been gradually prepared for its fall, the surrender of the fortress stunned him. He felt it was a disgrace. It left a scar on his mind. One evening, months later, when he was sitting in his bathroom enveloped in a towel, he stopped drying himself and gloomily surveyed the floor. 'I cannot get over Singapore,' he said, sadly." So what an absolute embarrassment. But beyond
that, should have picked a pistol up there and then done the decent thing.
Well, what else do you know about, why was it linked to him so much, this failure?
Well, apparently he was the one to say that the Japanese were not going to come via the jungle. They thought that terrain was too difficult to get through, and they expected a frontal attack when the Japanese came through the jungle.
On their push bikes.
On the push bikes, and took everybody by surprise. But it was Churchill who was given, the command to say, "Don't worry about them coming through the jungle."
So it was his strategic planning that was no good, basically. Well, that's like the Gallipoli disaster then, isn't it?
Yes, again, yeah. The guy gets away with murder, more or less.
Just arrogance and no strategic planning. Well, interestingly, as we actually learn there, there wasn't just British troops, it was British, Australian and Indian soldiers. And we have an example here of why it is so ridiculous to have non-white soldiers fighting for you, because they're just mercenaries, basically. But once they had actually captured all of these soldiers, because they got 100,000 of them to surrender, and they were all prisoners of war then, and there was an Indian revolutionary amongst them, amongst these soldiers, Rash Bihari Bose, and he formed the pro-independence Indian National Army with the help of the Japanese, who were highly successful in recruiting Indian soldiers that had been taken prisoner in February 1942 from a total of about 40,000 Indian personnel in Singapore, almost half, that is, of this battle force, about 30,000 joined the INA, of which about 7,000 fought the Allied forces in the Burma campaign, as well as in the northeast India regions of Kohima and Imphal. So that's 75% of the Indian personnel that had joined up with the British Army. You know, these ones that they like to concentrate on today and say, what a great job, you know, these non-white nations did fighting for us in the war. Three quarters of them decided to change allegiance to Japan.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, to be honest, they probably just signed up in the first place to get a decent meal. And, you know, when the Japanese come along, they probably got offered better pay as well. So I won't blame them, to be honest.
Well, I know that the guy that they actually he handed it over to later, he did have something to do with the National Socialists. He was in Berlin and he was trying to get support from Adolf Hitler for his nationalist organization that was in India. I think actually the guy that's is just momentarily gone out of my mind, the president of India, I think he's something to do with this nationalist party that was started by this Bose.
Yeah, well, there were Indians fighting for the Germans, which in several forces got somewhere. So I think I shot one or two turbans in the great story, which shot a lot of people.
Yeah, the Sikhs. I mean, the National Socialists had a lot of respect for the Aryan history of India. And you know, the Indian knows that at one time they were brothers to us, basically, and then they lost their racial integrity about 1,000 years or so back. But they know that at one time they were the Eastern brats and we were the Western brats. And even that word Vrata is, you know, it's the same as Brit, basically, and Britain. It's the same word that they actually use. So anyway, I mean, that's an example there of how daft it is when we look at the British government and they're advertising for Muslims to join the British Army. Because if something like this was to happen, you know, these Muslims would just go off and join the other Muslims, wouldn't they?
No.
I mean, this isn't even Indians going off to join Indians. This is Indians going off to join the Japanese and turning on us.
Examples in Afghanistan, aren't there, for Muslims in the British Army, right, have actually, you know, led the British contingent to where the car bomb is, you know. And these are men dying.
And we hear of it a lot in America with these Chinese that join the intelligence services, and then America places them in China as their man in China, and then they just disappear and give all the information to the Chinese that they've learnt from the American intelligence services. I mean, blood is thicker than water.
And that is so true.
If you don't understand that, then you know you will be made a fool of, just as you know Churchill was made a fool of here, and all the Western powers are being made a fool of because they seem to think that they're above the natural order and natural law. Well, the next bit we move out from the Asian theater and back to Europe, and we get Operation Gomorrah and the destruction of Germany. So you're going to highlight Churchill's attacks on Germany now. By 1943, the US had finally rearmed the British, and now the countries of capitalism and communism and those they dominated would combine to seek the total annihilation of one of the most advanced civilizations the world had ever seen. Under National Socialism, Germany, in just a few short years, had arisen from financial ruin and social degeneration to lead Europe in science, technology, art, and literature. It would now be surrounded, and Germany will eventually be attacked by 50 countries, led by the Soviet Union, Britain, and the United States. Do you want to just say something about the advances that the National Socialists had made and in comparison to the rest of the world, Dennis?
Well, we know after the war how the race and the stealing of all the patents, which of the inventions of the Germans, but I was just single out one particular one, like, which I heard the other day, like, was the fact that the microscopes could only phase up to 2,000 times. And they could look at a virus, but they couldn't really inspect what the virus did. And it was the Germans during the 30s what invented a microscope, which was like 13 times more powerful. And they could eventually see what this virus, how it did things. And obviously that was a great moment in science. But again, overlooked, and probably, you know, the pattern was probably stolen either by the Soviets or one of the Americans.
Magnetic tape. They came out with the magnetic tape, didn't they?
You know, alternatives to petrol, to morphine.
Artificial rubber they had, and a measure of how high their standard of living was, they had that the Beetle, the Volkswagen Beetle, which was for everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody could afford one. Everyone could afford a car. You think in Britain whether everybody could afford a car in 1939, 1940. You know, they couldn't afford a car.
Reliable cars there is, because there's not a lot you can go wrong on them.
Yeah, it's still going. I mean, Bjerknes, in that debate, he was trying to say that they didn't have a high standard of living, but the fact they had this car shows that they did, and they could afford it.
Yeah, well,
you know, that's just one example.
I know what he's about.
Well, over Hamburg, the Americans would strategically bomb industrial plants during the day, while the British would target the civilians by night, aiming at the tightly knit houses of the working class communities. In what was a heinous and barbaric war crime of epic proportions, instigated by Churchill and RAF Commander Arthur Bomber Harris, over 50,000 civilians would be incinerated in the ensuing firestorm that eventually became known as Germany's Hiroshima. So that was just over Hamburg, was it, the 50,000?
Yeah. And that put terror right throughout Germany, because they'd never known anything like this before, where, you know, they're literally being targeted, but not just being targeted, bombs are being designed to maximum, you know, incineration of them.
Maximum flame power, wasn't it? So they would explode, and then the flames would just burn through everybody.
Yeah.
And you'd get like a cyclone of heat with people flying up in it, because the heat was so hot, and they'd just be like incinerated and melted into the tarmac. Absolutely horrific.
And if that wasn't bad enough, the survivors who did manage to survive through all that, they came out shelters, and they were mowed down by airplanes with machine guns.
Yeah, they went in for the second run, didn't they, to go after the emergency services.
Yeah.
They tried to help anybody that had actually survived this. Well, the Allies expected the war to be over by Christmas, confident that the firebombing would force the Germans to turn on Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich. Yet no matter how many bombs the Allies dropped on the German cities, there would never be so much as a hint of an uprising against the Führer. As a result, the United States would now change their strategy of bombing industrial and military targets, and instead, the Americans would join the British in bombing the civilians. Which is a war crime.
Children, kids, women, yeah.
Deliberately targeting civilians is a war crime. And they'll use that today. They will accuse, like, Slobodan Milosevic of killing civilians. And they'll have a big court at The Hague. And yet, this is exactly what... It was the Allies that started doing this.
Yeah.
Attacking the civilians. We've got a quote from an eyewitness. She says, "People were sitting there in the cellar trembling, watching the walls tremble also. Those nights we can never forget. We asked ourselves, why are they doing this to our Führer? And we answered, because our Führer was trying to create a better world. Maybe the Allies thought this would make us surrender, but it made us all the more determined to do the opposite." And it really did. When they came in at the end there, into Berlin, it was children that were fighting and dad's army, basically, the home That's front. Right. And they were still fighting. It was the Hitler Youth and the old boys, right down to the last man. They defended what they had because they knew that it was a better world that they were trying to create. And this is why Magda Goebbels, committed suicide with all her children. Because they couldn't stand for them to see what the world would be like for them, because they'd known this other world that didn't have all this wickedness and corruption in it.
Plus, they were worried of the amount of communists and how far away they were. You know, if the communists ever got the children of Goebbels, who knows what they would have done with them.
Yeah, indeed. And they'd seen what had happened to Mussolini and his wife.
Yeah, which is never good.
In the aftermath of the firestorm, almost a million refugees fled Hamburg and caused a panic across Germany with the tales of what had happened. The American and British commanders remained committed to their strategies of bombing cities and industrial targets, including Berlin. So this panic, because, you know, the idea that these supposedly civilized nations would just start bombing the housing blocks was just... It's unbelievable to them.
That these I've got some footage that are using secret Masonic victory of, you can see the farmer being pulled along with his horse. Suddenly he's in a hail of bullets. And that's just a farmer in the middle of the field.
Well, you imagine living in these cities that are miles away from any industrial plants or any military targets, and you think you're going to be safe. You've got refugees there,
hospitals, children,
wounded, and they're bombing the hell out of it. It would be like Hitler going for the countryside where all their children have been evacuated to during the war, and then bombing that.
Yeah, with specially made bombs.
Yeah. To cause the most damage possible. And then you got another crime, another quote, sorry. What occurred was a crime so terrible the world had never before experienced. And what makes it even worse is the fact it is covered up. An attempt was made to destroy a nation entirely with terror bombing, rape of the survivors, and eventual starvation after the war. And I think that's Thomas Goodrich.
Yeah, it was.
Speaking there. Who I guess most listeners out there have heard of Thomas Goodrich. If you haven't, look him up. Have a look at his book, Hellstorm. And there's also another documentary that's actually been made on Hellstorm, which is highly recommended, with all the eyewitness reports of the terror bombing and the rape and the starvation that occurred. The Germans aren't allowed to grieve for.
Sorry?
I say the Germans, you know, they've never been able to properly grieve for this. They can't talk about it in public.
No, there's bodies still under the buildings today. It's a crime of epic proportions, but you know what really winds me up is when they say how wonderful Churchill was, and when you know all this, just how despicable of a human being he was, it really grates me.
Then we get the destruction of Berlin. Reversing years of American strategic policy, the United States decided to bomb Berlin. As many as 19 attacks were made over 6 months, with 800 bombers on a single mission, with nearly 11,000 bombing sorties. This attack on Berlin would have significance far beyond casualty numbers. The American Air Force had crossed a moral threshold, that of not deliberately bombing civilians. And there's a quote. Usually the moral divide for historians is the Tokyo raid, which took place in the next month and incinerated almost 100,000 people. But really, once that divide had been crossed in Berlin, it made everything else, including the atomic bomb, that little bit easier. So this was when the Americans started doing this.
Yes.
Which they've obviously continued. Now, I guess some people might say, "Oh, yes. Well, what about the Blitz? What about these German planes that were bombing London?" So, I mean, my answer to that would be that Churchill did his best to get Hitler to bomb London. There are records of him being furious that Hitler would not attack London because Churchill was already attacking these civilian places on the continent, and he was deliberately doing it to try and get Hitler to. hit landing or hit anywhere in Britain, because the British people didn't want to be in the war. They didn't want to be at war. And all the while Hitler refused to attack Britain, Churchill was unsteady in continuing to prosecute this war. So he was deliberately attacking the Germans for months before the Germans actually finally responded. So that would be my answer.
Plus, and from what I hear, it didn't protect Coventry either, as it should have been.
Well, as we've been told here, he didn't protect the Clyde, did he? Scots guy that they got there. So Churchill was deliberately not protecting these places because he wanted there to be dead British people, to get people against Hitler. Now, what about these attacks, Dennis? How do they compare, the attacks on Britain, Coventry, the Blitz in London, how do they compare with the terror bombing in Germany, that like the numbers killed and the damage done?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the total of the London bombings was about 40,000, where we're just seeing in one night, Hamburg blitz, 50,000 incinerated.
So more killed in one night in one city in Germany than the whole time in London.
Than the blitz, yeah, because there was an effective blitz anyway. In fact, I think one of the bombs actually strayed from where it should have been, and Churchill revelled in delight, saying, never can do this and never can do that. But simply because this bomb hadn't hit where it was intended, I think it hit it was supposed to be one of the docks, right? But it went off on a stray mission. I think probably killed a couple of civilians. That was it for Church. That's all he needed.
Yeah, because there was one instance, wasn't there, where a German fighter plane got lost, basically, and it ended up going up the Thames and firing at something which it wasn't intending to. I think David Irving talks about that and how that was exactly what Churchill had been looking for, to use that as an excuse.
To happen in time, because these things, obviously, they haven't got the equipment yet to nail it.
Well, as mentioned there, after that, we get to Japan and the atom bomb in Japan. The United States detonated two nuclear warheads over the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6th and 9th, 1945, respectively, with the consent of the United Kingdom, as required by the Quebec Agreement. And that's what you were mentioning earlier, Dennis. So
that's what I hadn't realised, yeah. I thought that America took it upon themselves, like, obviously, they needed the consent of the UK as well, which brings Churchill back into play.
Now, what was the Quebec Agreement then?
From what I can remember, I can remember Roosevelt and Churchill being there at some point, but I never quite found out what it was all about, you know.
Obviously, that would have been in Canada. I don't know. I don't recall Canada. Canada must have taken part in the war. Did Canada do much? Yeah. Can't think who the Prime Minister was at the time.
No, but it was a kind of a colony to us, wasn't it?
I guess, yeah. Well, Nagasaki was known as the Rome of Japan, a centre for Roman Catholicism. Japan, like Germany and the countries liberated by the National Socialists, had also banned Freemasonry. So you've got two points there. The centre of Roman Catholicism. And I guess most people aren't aware of that. You don't really think of the Japanese as Catholic or Christian. And I guess, well, that's why, because they destroyed the Catholic bit.
And the story behind that is that you always remember the first of anything, you know, like the first man on the moon, etc. So they bombed Hiroshima first and Nagasaki second. So you always remember Nagasaki before, or Hiroshima, focus on that rather than the reason why they bombed Nagasaki, which was, of course, Truman's revenge because they wiped out Freemasonry in Japan.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that they got rid of Freemasonry. Now, was that a part of the Emperor's ideology, or was that the Emperor emulating National Socialist ideology? I mean, was there much synergy between the two, whatever the Emperor was doing and the National Socialists? Because they called them honorary Aryans, didn't they, the Japanese?
Yeah, they did, yeah. And they had this try to pack with Italy. Whether or not it comes through the emperor or not, I really don't know. I think the consensus would have been that if they did know about Freemasonry, I'm pretty sure Hitler and Mussolini would have told them. And once learning about Freemasonry and its true point, then they would have got rid of it like any other decent country.
So they would have seen it as a third column, like a conspiratorial thing that could have been a threat to the government that would have been taking it over for the new world order.
And it's satanic rituals and occult meanings, and Jewish meanings as well, Jewish roots.
And I know that after the war, much like the wild accusations that were made against the Germans, they also made wild accusations against the Japanese.
Yeah, it looks like that's the usual thing. I mean, it took me a long time to realise that I could never remember any camps in Japan or any names of any camps. I couldn't find any, and that just leads you to the opinion that when the Americans were saying that these Japanese were just insane, they would commit suicide. They probably committed suicide because they knew they were going to get killed anyway.
Yeah, the kamikaze pilots. Now, I'm sure I can remember reading that these Japanese were horrific torturers, and if there were any American prisoners of war, they would be hideously tortured by the Japanese.
Yeah, a bridge over the river Kwai and all that, for slave labour. Who knows? But at least the Americans and the British were in a camp.
Well, I know that Simon Shepherd's got a book which deals with the Nuremberg trials, and near the end of the book it's got some quotes from the trials of the Japanese war criminals, just to highlight the, that it wasn't just against the Germans that they came out with these unbelievable accusations, because they got the same against the Japanese, and that's something that isn't really looked into, not with as much interest as what happened against the Germans.
But they were all against Freemasonry, and I'm pretty sure everybody in Nuremberg high up there were all Freemasons.
I mean, you don't hear of Japanese revisionism, do you?
Not at all, no.
But you do hear of the Japanese exposing Jewish conspiracies and things like that.
I think the guy who did Elstorm, I think he did a documentary not long back on Japan. I haven't read it yet, but I believe it's excellent. Michael Goodridge.
Yeah, I remember there being some YouTubes a while back that were Japanese origin. And there was also a North Korea one that was exposing propaganda and conspiracies and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, believe it or not, with this virus, what's going on at the moment, they've more or less confirmed now that it is a bioweapon. They believe that America sold it to China. China went back there and developed it, and somehow it's escaped, whether it on purpose or not, who knows. But actually, in the war with America, with Korea, America were dropping germs on Korea.
Oh, it was horrific, that war with Korea. That's why the North Koreans are so against America. They're still at war to this day. They never had an armistice or a peace. And, there was starvation, wasn't there? Of all the North Koreans.
Yeah, and flattened every building going again, every city.
They do have a right, the North Koreans do have a right to be very, very upset and annoyed at America. And again, what is America doing interfering in North Korea, between North and South Korea?
I don't know if they're doing in North Korea at the moment with this virus, but I know South Korea's, they're doing well.
And you can make
North Korea just looks
You can make the argument that the Americans did have an interest in what was going on in Europe because the Americans were of European stock. But what are the Americans doing prosecuting a war in North Korea?
Well, I think like they're prosecuting a war in the Middle East. It's no different. I think it's just a world domination. That's all.
Well, it is now. It is now, isn't it? But up until this World War One and World War Two, I mean, America had not been involved in anything like this.
Well, no, I found out in Masonic Victory that they actually funded the Spanish Revolution, but through the Soviet Union. And it eventually came out that the bankers were funding them, and Stalin, of course, were funding them. But it were all covertly up to that point. I mean, nobody even knew the bankers were involved in the Russian Revolution. That came out later. So they were doing things. And in the war, I've read an amazing set of newspaper headlines in Masonic Victory of Roosevelt, what he was trying to do to get in the war, sending warships into war zones, hoping that the Americans get an excuse to jump in. Then he sent in armed warships into the war zones. So he did everything possible he could to get in that war.
Well, I'm sure the American bankers were using subversive techniques well over a century ago. But what I mean is that the troops, America would never have sent an army in to get involved in a war outside of America until after the Second World War. And after the Second World War, Americans were involved everywhere.
The war that was Spain was supposed to be a false flag. When they took Cuba from Spain, Spain didn't really want a war.
Well, that's Cuba.
No more warships.
That's Cuba. That's just off the coast of Florida. North Korea is thousands of miles away from America. That's what I mean. This involvement of America getting involved in wars in the Middle East and Vietnam, it wasn't normal until after World War II.
Well, I haven't worked Vietnam out yet, because if you can defeat Germany and the likes of Japan and Italy in World War II, and you've got all the technology going against Vietnam, and you don't win that war, then you never intended winning that war, is my opinion.
Well, let's move on to the Welsh miners here. We've got 5 minutes to go. Winston Churchill died on the 24th of January 1965, aged 90, after suffering a stroke. Although he is regarded as Britain's greatest statesman, Winston Churchill has never been forgiven by the Welsh for sending the British Army to break up the 1910 miners' strike in South Wales. The result was the deaths of two Welsh miners after a bayonet charge on an unarmed crowd. In 1965, the Welsh Valleys celebrated upon hearing of Churchill's death. You're lucky there was just two of them that were killed. Imagine a bayonet charge. So she's just running in and stabbing the Welsh miners for protesting.
But it's your own army. That makes it even worse.
And again, this disproves this idea that Churchill was a white supremacist, because he had no qualms about attacking white people. None.
Not at all.
Even white people from his own nation or from his own country that he was supposed to be the representative of, quite happy to go in there and kill them. And, you know, at the expense of having the Welsh, you know, really disliking the guy ever since, for decades after what he did.
Piers Morgan got TV and defend the guy.
Well, Piers Morgan
doesn't really defend him because he doesn't mention any of this, you know what I mean? He just mentions he won the war, you know what I mean?
Piers Morgan just knows the Hollywood history, doesn't he? He doesn't actually know any of the history of his own country and what the people of his own country actually thought of the guy. This is the thing. Right. You know, people just believe what Hollywood tells them. When you don't have to go back that far to see that it was a completely different story and a completely different mindset that the British people had. They weren't supporting of Churchill. He was totally disliked. Well, then we get to the final body count, where you top them all up. We've got Lusitania, from with all those American civilians on board that was set up by Churchill so that the Germans would hit it, basically, and it was filled up with weaponry. So instead of them being able to be rescued, they were blown up by all the illegal munitions that the Americans had put on board to smuggle to the English, again, set up by Churchill, 2,000. Then we get the French fleet. The French Navy, don't forget that there had been a promise and a handshake and no, we won't do this from Churchill to the Admiral of the French fleet, 1,300 French sailors, which the French are still annoyed at him for. And that Scottish MP didn't mention the French, did he? But they're still not happy with Churchill. And they're supposed to have been liberated by him. And they're still not happy with him. And you get the Bengal famine, so we get the non-whites now, 4 million. Four million of them, which we covered right at the beginning of this series. The Blyberg massacre, 700,000 Slavs that had come to the British for assistance to try and get away from the communists, pretty much like these refugees now that are coming to us that we let in. Only these were white refugees. And 700,000 of them were just massacred. They were just turned around and given to the communists to do what they wanted with. Killed them within earshot and eye shot. You know, some of the British soldiers were watching as it happened, as we covered. Cossack repatriation. Again, white people that had come to the British to not even just to surrender, really, but just for asylum. I mean, these people have come to Britain for asylum, and this is what Britain did to them, sent them back to the Soviets. Ireland, we don't know how many in Ireland. And that was with the Black and Tans, wasn't it, that Churchill was involved in. The Kurds, we don't know how many of the Kurds that he gassed. Another more non-whites. The Gallipoli disaster, 150,000. That's where he sent British troops on a suicide mission to try and invade the Ottoman Empire, thinking that that would be very easy to do. And they ended up getting stuck on the beach, couldn't even advance up the beach for 3 months, 6 months, was it?
That's right, they were bogged down, yeah.
6 months they were stuck there on the beach in the heat, dug into trenches, just like elsewhere in the First World War, and exactly what this campaign was supposed to avoid. Straight away, within days, within hours, I think, they were stuck in trenches, weren't they, and then didn't move for 6 months. Starving of the Germans after World War One, 900,000, almost a million of them. And what was Churchill's direct involvement in that, Dennis, starving of the Germans?
Well, it was Lord of the Air and Navy, weren't he? And obviously the blockade was a naval blockade to stop food getting in there.
Right, Lord of the Admiralty.
So Lord of the Admiralty, yeah.
So he could have allowed supplies in. European Christians, I take it this is in the Second World War, 66 million. Yeah. 66 million because Churchill refused to accept Hitler's offers of peace. Japanese Christians, 150,000. Is that Nagasaki, is it?
Yeah.
And Hiroshima. And Welsh miners, two. And the estimated total, a round figure of 73 million. 73 million deaths at the hands of Winston Churchill. Shouldn't it be 73 million and two?
Well, yeah, but, you know, we'll never be sure of the exact amount. It is an estimated figure. We probably don't even know some of the other atrocities that he may have done, but I think 73 million tells its story, Mr. Morgan. Yeah.
And allied with the Soviets as well. And to think,
which is why he included the Christians in Europe, because that's exactly what they did.
And I think people think he's our greatest Briton. He's our worst Briton. Well, that brings us to the end of the show, Dennis. Thank you very much for coming on. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truth Without Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.